So, we are now moving through conversations with Yogananda, even though there's a lot of other subjects on people's minds tonight. I'm not going to talk so much about everything else. I'm probably going to start doing a series of short satsangs in the mornings, starting tomorrow at 9 o'clock Pacific time. And we'll do several a week, depending on how the flow goes, maybe even every day, depending on how things go, we'll see. And a couple of weeks ago at Sunday service, when all of this was first happening to the planet, I gave a Sunday service entirely on this subject. So tonight I'm going to more or less stick to the book, except insofar as my own mind is preoccupied with the state of the world. And then we'll see what happens, because I actually never know what's going to happen. I always just start in and leave it to Divine Mother to tell me. Because we don't have an in-house audience, for those who are joining later, we're now, we've closed our church for the duration and are only working online from there, and have set up in Chela Bhavan, the House of the Disciples, which is where I live. We've set up this recording studio and we'll be doing a lot of transmitting from here too. For those who watch my webinars, what are actually called webinars, they happen in this setting. So now, last week we did one, which was not so unusual, because we often do just one, and it was about lion-like swamis, and the whole conversation turned out to be about the new renunciate order being a Naya Swami, which actually, I'm referencing it. I don't know if it's online yet, for those of you who only watch recordings. Sometimes these don't go up as fast as other of our recordings do. I just ended up talking the whole time about being a Naya Swami and 10 years ago and what that meant to me and various other parts of it. And at the end, someone asked me what renunciation meant, and I tried to recite the Naya Swami vow. Strangely, big pieces of it were missing from my mind, but it's all come back. And it's available in a new, if you look up the Naya Swami order or a new renunciate order online, you'll find it. I mentioned that because that talk also really was very touching for me also. The thing about talking as much as I do about Master's teachings and, you know, my schedule when I'm living here in Palo Alto, when I'm at home, is not as arduous as it is, or not as action-packed and fun-filled as it is when I'm traveling, when I can speak every day or even several times a day. And at this point in my life, I don't plan very much. Sometimes ahead of time something will occur to me, and if it's a good thought and it stays with me, I'll use it. But a lot of it is just surrendering to the spirit and seeing what is being pulled out of me, what the audience is pulling out of me, what Divine Mother, what message she has in the moment. You know, I'm talking into a camera now, which is, and there are actual real people on the other side of it because it's real-time streaming. But when we started having to put everything online, I was talking to a friend who was less experienced in doing things this way. And I remembered when Swami recorded his television shows for India. That would have been about 2004, maybe 2005. And he had just moved there and realized that he was too elderly to travel around India in the way he'd done in 1958 and 59 when he was there as a young man. He just didn't have the physical stamina. But what had developed in all those years in between were these spiritually dedicated television channels. So Swamiji realized that he could reach millions of people in India with a recorded show. Pre-recorded show is how he would do it. So he set up a schedule, and I talked about this both in my book Light Bearer, which I'm going to shamelessly plug this evening, in Light Bearer, and also in Swami Kriyananda as We Have Known Him. I told the story in different ways in both books. But one of the things was, there were a few people in the room when Swami was recording. It was a great opportunity to be with him. actually came over from America to be part of it, just to watch. But I asked Swamiji, you know, he often said how the audience actually determines the content of a talk, and he would say, much more than most people realize, it's the quality of the audience that determines the quality of the talk, because their receptivity, the creativity of their own thoughts, it's like Divine Mother. The way I feel about it is, Divine Mother hears and then puts the thoughts into my mind and I express them for her. As one of my friends put it, she said her prayer before every class was, God, you don't have a mouth and I don't have a brain. So if we work together, maybe we can do something useful. But when Swami was recording for something that wouldn't be shown maybe for weeks or even months, I asked him sort of, how do you do it? How does that fit? And he said, I feel the consciousness of the people who are going to listen. I don't know if he was telling me that he could step outside of time, or as he described once about the state of superconsciousness, that there's no time. That comment came when he was referencing the superconscious state he would enter spontaneously as a child, compared to the superconscious state he learned to enter through the practice of Kriya after he became a disciple of Master. But he said he went to the same place, and in that place there was no time. So was Swami telling me that when he was recording those shows, he was in a superconscious place where the future and the present were the same? I don't know. I didn't think to ask him to elucidate it. He just stated it that way. So in any case, what I was saying was that in order for sharing of these spiritual teachings to be meaningful, at least from the way Swamiji taught us to do it and the way I've experienced it all these decades, is that it also has to be new for me. It also has to be a revelation of, on some level, not perhaps an absolute divine superconscious revelation. That would be too much to hope for. If that were the criteria, then I would never speak again. But it has to be a learning experience for me. I have to also be learning. Otherwise there's little value is the way I would put it. I don't mean to sound selfish in saying that, because that does sound a bit selfish, doesn't it? If there's nothing in it for me, then it's not worth doing. But it's more like the nature of the way Swamiji has taught us to speak means that we need to be sufficiently in the moment that what's happening is new. And again, I don't want to overstate this, but there's a quality sometimes of sharing with people, which fortunately doesn't happen to me that often. Or if I fall into it, I can, by the grace of God, extricate myself, which is what I call teaching from memory, where I hear myself repeating what I've said before. Now, of course, naturally I repeat what I've said before because there's only so many words. But when it sounds to me like I'm just repeating it, then I know that I have to pray more deeply, put out more energy, ask God for more help, so that in the moment I too will be hearing something that's true spoken in a way that also speaks not only from my heart, but actually to my heart. So after last week's class, which is what this is all about, when I was talking almost the whole time about the Nyaswami order and ultimately what it meant to be me to be a Nyaswami, even in the moment, but especially as I reflected on it later, I was so grateful that I'd been, I started to say inspired, perhaps instructed, been inclined to talk about it in such length and such depth, because it truly is, well, it's everything on the spiritual path. You know, this, the longer I'm on the path, the more the hand-to-hand combat with delusion becomes more and more focused in my thinking. You know, the whole thing just takes place inside our own consciousness. Swamiji talks about how, let me think how he, what the context was. But it was when he was a new disciple and he was just realizing and he was trying to comfort someone else by talking about how it's all just happening inside your own head. But of course that's the most terrible place for it to be. That's the best place for it to be, because when we master ourselves, we've mastered everything. But it's the worst place for it to be because it's inescapable. We simply are our state of consciousness. And the path of formal renunciation, where more than the intention, the commitment, is to repudiate the security of all external things. It's a little complicated nowadays. From Master's time, he himself said that Saint Francis was devoted to Lady Poverty. And Francis lived, you know, at the most austere edge of what it was required to keep a human being alive. And Master said that he is devoted to Lady Simplicity. And this is partly because we're shifting yugas, moving out of Kali Yuga when spirit and matter were completely incompatible. If you went for the spiritual life, you just had to repudiate the material life. They simply could not be combined. In the age of Dwapara, it's possible to bring the spiritual, to integrate the spiritual and material, to live a spiritual life without having to be so severe in our repudiation of the material. But then you see the temptation crosses our minds that make us think we can actually compromise with delusion. And even Swami's own writing, and the example of the way he lived, he had a bank account, but for that matter, Master had a bank account. Swami had a bank account. He didn't have savings particularly at all, but he had a bank account. He had money in his wallet. He had control over his own money. People gave him money. He used it as he felt to use it. He didn't refuse to touch it like Ramakrishna did. He didn't find the presence of a gold coin in his hand. It didn't burn him like it burned Ramakrishna. Swami had a car and comfortable clothes, and he traveled. And he didn't live like Francis, in other words, nor did Master. But the repudiation of the necessity for those things and the repudiation of the egoic involvement with all those things is there's no compromise on that. And so the internal has to be as draconian as the external used to be. So it's a very interesting challenge. All of this came from last week, number 447, in reference to lion-like swamis. And lion-like swamis would have to exemplify that absolute commitment to the spirit as the only reality. A friend of mine, I was talking to her about some thoughts that were going through my head. And she, being very Vedantic meaning just repudiating the reality of this world, was emphasizing how it's only a thought. And after she gave me this little impassioned speech, which was quite lucid and actually quite helpful, about how it's only a thought and you erase the thought, I told her, well, I'll think about what you said. I also said, I'm listening very thoughtfully, or I mean unthoughtfully, to what you're saying. You know, it gets all so confused. But nonetheless, here we are. And in the present moment, referencing this pandemic that seems to be sweeping the world. And all of the absolute chaos it's causing and will continue to cause economically and in that countless other ways, we hardly know. I mean, maybe by the grace of God, it will be short-lived. Maybe by the grace of God, it won't be. This is the time to go deep. And last week about renunciation, this is, of course, something formal that I have done. It's put a name to the practice, and that's not at all necessary. A devotee of God is a devotee of God. I put a name to the practice because it suits me to do so, and it doesn't suit everyone. It's a bondage for some, or a useless for others, and a great aid for some of us. It's all just what it is. So anyway, that's a little more about 447, but we're actually at 448. So now I'm going to read this one, which is also very short. A bent spine, the master used to tell his students, is the enemy of realization. Whenever we all read that one, we all sit up a little straighter. Whenever that Swami would make that comment, I know sometimes in a class or something, Swami would refer to that. And you know, you didn't want to just in the moment pop up like this, but you would watch the whole room kind of surreptitiously, everybody try to tighten their spine up a little bit and lift their heart and open out just a little bit more. And you know, Master, he was talking literally, physically, that the physical body is sometimes the easiest way to access these states of consciousness. I know many of us, including me, back in 1966, when I first became interested or became exposed to, when I first discovered, let me phrase it more differently even than that, when God first gifted me with an understanding of the path of self-realization. I know that I went at it in the only way I could think of, which was diet and yoga postures. And not that I'm not still, yoga postures has never been a primary practice of mine. I mean, after the first few years, I really have rarely practiced yoga at all, ever. I energize, I exercise, but yoga, it's not worth explaining. Probably would have been good for me to do more, but at the stage I haven't yet. But I did then, because it was easier to understand my body than it was to understand my spirit. It was easier to access my consciousness by doing physical things. And of course, yoga now, especially, particularly Ananda Yoga, because it's so oriented toward the true actual purpose of yoga, which is to calm the physical body and make it a non-factor in our ability to concentrate. Because the physical body can be a great distraction to the ability to concentrate. And what the yoga postures do is they harmonize the physical body and free it of its obstacles, and then we can achieve asana. And asana is to be able to sit firmly without moving. But I remember it was easier to put my body into a position, and with Swamiji's affirmations, then I would know what that physical attribute would help create in my body. And so I could access it all by changing myself physically. When I gradually learned the energization exercises, which came a little bit later, not too much later, I also saw, again, that was something, the energization exercises are Master's original contribution to the practice of yoga. You know, these things have been around so long, yoga postures and the mudras and even just spiritual symbols and things like that, that we tend to think of them as, we tend to not think of them as ever having an origin point. But the divine uses instruments to bring everything into the world. So there was a time when some great realized being had a revelation, a superconscious revelation, that this particular position of the physical body would have this particular harmonious effect on both the mind, the spirit, and the body. And so all of these things were created at some point by somebody. And then, of course, they have endured because they have been reflections of the truth, you know, in what, how many ages past, because Sanatana Dharma is the eternal religion. So there's no time at which it didn't exist, but in different ages, in different civilizations, in different planets, in different yugas, I'm beyond myself in saying all this. Each of these things was brought forth because the timing was right. And then it would endure as long as human consciousness was able to hold it. And then if the planet got too dark or the time changed or who knows. These are things, again, beyond my portfolio to really understand deeply. It would shift again. But now in this age of Dwapara Yuga, Master came and his original contribution is the energization exercises, which is this, I believe it's 32. The number escapes me because I haven't been responsible for teaching them for a long time, in which we draw energy through the medulla and we learn by willpower to control energy. And we first learn that by learning to control it in the body. And we do it by creating, by willpower alone, energy in the body in the form of tension. And then by consciously relaxing that tension and withdrawing the energy. So it's not calisthenics. It's calisthenics when you get the heart rate up and you strain the muscles and then in pushing them a little bit, then they become stronger and all of that. Energization has really nothing to do with any of that, although it does have enormous physical benefits. I've enjoyed great good health through my whole life, and God willing, I will continue to. It's completely in His hands. But I'm certain that insofar as my own actions have contributed to that, energization has been a large part of it. But what we're doing with energization is we're training ourselves to understand that energy is a factor of willpower and that willpower is a conscious choice. And when we do the energization exercises as they are intended to do, we're training our concentration and we're training our willpower. And the energization exercises are an end in themselves for the dynamic physical well-being they give us and for the capacity they give us to use our body to accomplish whatever we set our mind to accomplish. But the greater purpose of the energization exercises is to gain mastery of ourselves by the use of willpower, so that when we go into the realm I was talking about earlier, which is the deeper realm, where we're trying to control our inner consciousness and our inner thoughts, the practice of understanding, because you see, thoughts are nothing but energy also. And this is it's what my friend was trying to explain to me. It's just an energy pattern. And so much about our thoughts is what we have remembered from the past and how we've characterized that and what we anticipate for the future, none of which has a material reality. All of it is just an energy pattern. So energization exercises themselves are an extremely direct way of getting mastery over the mind and getting mastery over the mind so that we can have access to the spirit. So referring to March 17, 2020, when we're under assault from this microscopic being who seems to have an evil intention toward human well-being, the energization exercises are a tremendous antidote to it. Antidote to it on the physical plane, because the studies have been done. Energization exercises themselves greatly strengthen the immune system. Energization exercises give us a sense of mastery which is a direct antidote to a sense of helplessness that a microscopic entity that could be transported by God knows what means into our into the intimacy of our own body, it gives us a powerful sense of vibratory shield. And then that dynamic self-mastery gives us power over our thoughts, because the greatest enemy to our well-being is fear, always. I can say that easily, but I know it's not so simple. I mean, it's, we can speak platitudes to each other, which are helpful, and we can speak affirmations to ourselves, which are very helpful. But at the same time, it's always this balance between habits of weakness from the past and the promise of divinity in the future and the battleground of the conscious mind right now. This is what we're always fighting with, which is superconsciousness tells us of our potential and promises God's constant presence to make that potential a reality. Subconscious remembers everything, all of our past disappointments, all of our past sorrows, everything that didn't work in the past. It also tempts us to think that by dulling our awareness, we can actually diminish our suffering. And you see, that's a very sneaky delusion, because dulling our awareness temporarily eases our suffering. But the difficulty with it, of course, is it wears off. Even lifetime after lifetime, it wears off. And sooner or later, we have to face into it. So where we're always living is superconsciousness is pulling us toward absolute freedom. Subconsciousness is trying to persuade us either that we that it's not true or that it's too much effort. And the conscious mind is literally the battleground. The conscious mind is nothing but the battleground. And sometimes the subconsciousness pulls us toward what we have always been, and sometimes the superconscious wins and pulls us toward our absolute state of freedom, bliss in our destiny. And the battle never stops. That's why Master says a bent spine is the enemy of realization. Even his use of that word enemy, it's like it tells us right there that it's a fight. You know, every great epic of literature and spirit is always a battle. And there's a hero and there's a terrible villain, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, Homer's writings, the Iliad. You know, it's always a battle. And there was a period of time when this new spirituality was just beginning to come in the 60s when I was moving with it. And a lot of new thought was coming in, and it became very unpopular to talk about Satan. And it became very unpopular to talk about the dark force. And there was a sort of a positivity movement that tried to say, because our true nature is one with God, then we are one with God even now, and tried to repudiate the idea of struggle. Now, there was a certain positivity in that, which Swamiji himself has often reaffirmed, and Master has reaffirmed, because the traditional Catholic emphasis, especially in Christianity to a large extent, focused on the crucifixion of Jesus and focused tremendous extent on the suffering. And so it became that to be spiritual was to suffer, because if we were going to imitate Jesus, we needed to suffer as he suffered. But the real message of Jesus' life was not the suffering, but the transcendence, both on the cross and in his resurrection. But so when Swamiji, when Master came to tell us that the spiritual path is bliss. And I'm in his poem, Samadhi, which is his extraordinary poetic description of that which can hardly be conceived of, much less described. At the end of this whole description, his last lines are, a tiny bubble of laughter. I am become the sea of mirth itself. A tiny bubble of laughter. I am become the sea of mirth itself. That it all comes to bliss. It all comes to joy. And everything that we didn't experience as bliss was only a misunderstanding. So what Master came to teach and what Swami came to teach, he traveled around the country twice, teaching the subject, the practice of joy. That joy itself was not merely the goal or the reward, but the conscious, active use of the willpower to create a joyous response to life was actually what the spiritual path was all about. Simple? Yes. Easy? No. But when Swami wrote the Festival of Light, which was given to him from a higher source, and he wrote that in 1986. Yes, in the fall of 1986, he was in seclusion in Assisi. And he'd said afterwards, he said, for many years, he had desired to create a simple ritual that could be integral to our Sunday service, that would contain within it the essence of our spiritual path. He said, you know, a creed that you could recite, or principles that you could read, or something like that. He said, people would hear it and they would understand it, but he knew there was a need for a poetic summation of the essence of self-realization that we could participate in as a ritual worship week after week. And that by both the meaning, and Swami emphasized very strongly, the rhythm of the words, it would go ever deeper into the subconscious. Now, I spoke about the subconscious as being the downward pulling force, but I really need to clarify that. The subconscious is the repository. And the limitation of the subconscious is that it is not in itself creative, but it merely collects and then offers back to us whatever it is we have been up until this moment. So our past lives are stored there, our past regrets, also our past victories, our past hopes, our joyous expectations, and it all becomes ever new in the superconscious. So a tremendous part of the spiritual path is the right, consistent, you call it appropriately, programming of the subconscious. Swami Kriyananda actually wrote an entire course of self-transformation, which he called superconscious living, the art of superconscious living. And it strongly includes how to work with the subconscious mind. And this is where affirmations and positive thinking and right thinking, all of that comes in. So we want to fill the subconscious mind with positive images so that it will feed us. That's what it will feed us. When we look back toward habit, habit will be a habit of positive thinking. and not a habit of negative limitation. And gradually what happens then, the subconscious becomes our ally in our quest for superconsciousness. At a certain point, Swamiji said something very interesting, which I put somewhere in various of the books. But he mentioned once that in his sleep state, he was exactly the same as he was in his waking state. That his subconscious mind, and what he actually said to me, although later this is what I'm remembering. I wrote this into my first book, Swami Kriyananda as We've Known Him. And Swami made me modify it because he felt it was not something appropriate for him to say. But we said in essence was that he had no subconscious. That and what he was also saying was that there was no karma in his chakras. That everything had been resolved, which he said in other places also. This was something that Master said to him, and that in the Book of Bhrigu it was also stated that he had no future lives, that it was finished, and that in this incarnation all remaining karma, and I'm saying the word Jivan Mukta, Swami never used that word for himself, but that's the definition of what he's saying, all remaining unresolved karma was balanced, and at the end would be moksha. This was Master's promise to him. But in the context of that, Swami mentioned that in the subconscious sleep state, he never behaved differently than he did in the conscious state. Now, just to contrast that, you know, oftentimes fears I'm not aware of, desires I didn't know I had, unresolved angers. I mean, it happens to most of us. In the sleep state, when the conscious mind isn't there to filter or censor or suppress, often things come out that we didn't know. And of course, we learn things. I do. I learn things in my dreams. I learn things from what disturbs me in meditation. Sometimes when I haven't been aware that something was bothering me, and then I sit to meditate, and when I try to release a little bit of that strong censoring power of the conscious mind, sometimes something subconscious will come up. Well, all of that is to take me back to when Swami was talking about the power and the purpose of the Festival of Light and his writing it and the way he worked to write it and how he wanted it to be for us. He felt if strong teachings and strong affirmative statements are presented with rhythm, with not just in a clear expository way, but in a way that has grace and music to it. And I don't just mean melody. I mean music in the sense of poetic music. And if we come together week after week, as we do in our Ananda communities, in which all of you who tune into our live stream of our Sunday services here, we repeat those teachings over and over again, and those phrases begin to come back to us, and specifically the one that I was going to talk about here because of this word enemy. Swami says, whereas in the past, suffering and sorrow were the coin of man's redemption. For us now, that payment has been exchanged for calm acceptance and joy. So this was his refinement of an effort by a well-intentioned and not entirely misguided effort by, I don't know whether the word is new thought, I don't really know. These were the movements of the 60s, 70s, 80s, into the 90s, where people wanted to the spiritual life to be light, lighthearted, and wanted to repudiate the idea of sin and repudiate the idea of a satanic force or a devil or a darkness that we had to fear. And they also wanted to repudiate the idea of effort. They wanted to think that because we are one with God, we can just be one with God without having to face and overcome all the false ideas that have held us from that realization until now. Somewhere in these whispers, there was the conversation between Master and one of his disciples where Master said, you know, if you say you're free, if you just declare that you're free, you will be free. And one of the disciples said, well, sir, if I just said I'm free, I won't be free, will I? And Master laughed and said, well, you've answered your own question. Because so many incarnations of not believing in that freedom have to be met with the same amount of energy. You see, the whole thing is a magnetic balance. And all of those wrong thoughts, limited thoughts, thoughts of ourselves as other than one with God, they're an energy, they're a magnetism. And the more we repeat them, the more they build up. And in order to dissolve them, we have to have a wave of energy that has as much force to dissolve them and free them to rise upward as is stored there to hold our consciousness downward. Now, in theory, all that delusion could be dissolved in a split second. But for most of us, because we live in the realm of time and we believe in the realm of time, and we don't have access to the full power of our divinity, it takes time. And so we progress through one lifetime, we progress through a year, a week, a month, an incarnation, many incarnations, until we have put sufficient energy on the side of truth that quite simply the balance tips. You know, it's interesting. They say that every 12 years there's an astrological, you finish an astrological cycle, and spiritually there's a very strong relationship between astrology and the chakras, and it's a whole science. Swami goes into it in the Raja Yoga course, and it's a fascinating study. We may even be giving a course here, because Keshav, who lives with us now, is an astrologer, and will be giving a course, I hope, in some coming cycle on this. But I remember when I turned 36, which coincided with having been a disciple of Master and living at Ananda for 12 years, because I came just when I turned 24. And I can't say that when I turned 36, I suddenly became someone I hadn't been before, but I was very conscious of the fact that my subconscious and my superconscious mind I'd always been struggling. And my subconscious mind, the only way I can think of it, it hadn't been my friend. It seemed to be inclined to choose the worst. And really, just as my 36th birthday came, I felt like it just tipped. I mean, it tipped like an almost imperceptible amount, but enough so that, you know, if you set a marble down on a slick surface, a smooth marble on a slick surface, if there's even the slightest tilt, the marble will roll in that direction. It won't remain stationary. And I felt that after 12 years of very serious spiritual effort, it didn't always look serious, but it was. Let me phrase it differently. It didn't always look effective, but it was serious. It was the best I could do. I felt like my subconscious mind just imperceptibly, but sufficiently, tipped in the direction of superconsciousness. I'd been feeding it enough of the right attitude, the right experiences, the right practices, that it had just turned just that little bit. And by no means am I the same person when I sleep, and by no means are my chakras clear. But just that little tip is huge. And so Swamiji, in putting that phrase into the Festival of Light, by calm acceptance and joy, by calm acceptance and joy, but he's still telling us, that there is a coin of man's redemption, that whereas the coin of man's redemption in the past was suffering and sorrow, now that coin has been exchanged for calm acceptance and joy. Now, calm acceptance and joy is by no means effortless. It's just that knowing that where we're going is bliss, it gives us hope. It gives us a way to approach that dynamically. Now, I'm coming all the way back to a bent spine is the enemy of self-realization. So the straight spine in itself, I mean, just think about it. There's so many different ways to reflect on it just physically. And of course, everybody's body is constituted differently. And even if you're injured and you can't stand up, you can't be straight, a straight spine is also an inner attitude. And one of the most interesting things about a bent spine, well, I'll start it back to meeting Swamiji. By the end of Swamiji's life, his body had begun to, it was worn out. He used it very hard to work out much karma for many people. And so it was quite diminished. And, you know, how he had presented himself as a young man when he was 44, which was when I first met him, was quite different when he was 86 or whatever it was when he actually passed away. But when I met him, he had this extraordinarily notable posture, which is his shoulders were always back. He was very straight up. His spine was extremely straight. And his chest was slightly extended, so that from the side, he actually looked like the bow, the strung bow. In the Bhagavad Gita and in the Mahabharata, the hero, Arjuna, is an archer. That's who he is. And he has a bow. And literally, there's a straight string and the curved bow. And there's lots of stories about his bow and how only he could bend it and so on like that. And it was a very powerful image. But what the image really represents is the straight spine and the open chest, the open heart. And so even though people tend to think about straightening their spine, kind of pulling up on their shoulders and pulling up on their head, the best way to straighten the spine is actually to open the heart and to slightly raise the heart. If we think of the spiritual eye looking out from the spiritual eye, when we're looking at the spiritual eye, we're not looking inward to the forehead. We're looking out through the spiritual eye. The seat of our consciousness is the medulla, and the medulla is the opposite pole of the chakra, which is the sixth chakra, which is the spiritual eye. And we're looking through the spiritual eye with our eyes closed when we meditate. The spiritual eye being slightly above the horizon line, the medulla being slightly below, meaning the eyes making the horizon line, we automatically raise our eyes when we look through the spiritual eye. So the location of the spiritual eye, sometimes we teach people is to extend your hand like this and look at your thumb, and where your two eyes together can focus on your thumb, that's essentially where your gaze is when you close your eyes and look at the spiritual eye. So if you think of the spiritual eye as being, even though it's not really physically there, but if we think of it in order to orient ourselves when we're still in our bodies, slightly above the horizon line and in front of us, and if we feel that our heart, that there's a cord going from the heart chakra here, being pulled into the spiritual eye, then automatically the heart goes forward. And in pulling the heart forward, the shoulders automatically go back and the spine goes straight. And that, in addition to all the esoterica of the Irda and the Pingala and the Shushumna and the energies going up and down the spine, the breath, all the other elements, even just the physiology of the physical nerves running through the spine and needing the space and the openness not to be crimped so that the physical body will work, all of that too. But just from the idea of opening the heart and offering ourselves and our love and our being into the light, automatically the posture is what it should be. And I realized when you looked at Swami Kriyananda from the side, it's like the plane, if you think of his, if he were walking through the sea or just walking through air, it's like he met the world heart first. And I'll add to this, which was all part of an understanding I came to, which is I grew up in an intellectual family. I started reading at a very young age. I always like to read. I like words, intellectuality, using the mind in an interesting way. It was just how I was raised and how I'm profoundly karmically inclined, which is why I'm doing what I'm doing, why I've written books and all of those things. That's just who I am. And intelligence, per se, I enjoy. I know that I've learned that intelligence is not wisdom, and that the kind of intellectual intelligence that entertains me is entirely independent of realization and is not in itself a sign of realization, nor is it required for realization. But it's something I've always enjoyed. And I was very grateful that Swamiji has had a similar inclination. And so he was always extremely intellectually interesting. And I just loved to converse with him about philosophical topics or anything, because he was so intelligent in his perception of things. But gradually I began to realize that I was intelligent to a degree. But Swamiji was wise, and his intelligence was based on wisdom, and mine was just based on cleverness, and there was just a universe of difference. And I aspired to be him. I aspired to be like him, to have his state of realization. I mean, that's what my whole life has been. Swami to me is the embodiment of everything I wish to achieve for myself. So I aspire to turn whatever intelligence my DNA had given me into wisdom. And so I would often ponder what was the secret of his insight, his capacity, which just eluded me by comparison. And I remembered how Master talked about reason follows feeling. And it took me a long time to understand that. And it's a whole subject in itself, which I won't go into so much. But if we have a predisposition to a certain point of view, our thoughts will follow that point of view. I mean, this goes back to using energization exercises to master fear. Once fear gets a grip on us, all our thoughts and reasons are just absolutely molded by that fear. I mean, in March 17th, 2020, faced at the opening edge in America of what may turn out to be a terrible pandemic, by the grace of God, maybe we'll head it off, but we don't know. But once fear gets a hold of our thoughts, we just spin lots of thoughts and they're all seem so reasonable. And this is how good people can do terrible things out of prejudice and bigotry and amazing things, because reason follows feeling. But what I realized about Swamiji was that he wasn't afraid. He just wasn't afraid. Swamiji just wanted what was true. He didn't care what the truth was. He just wanted to know what was true. He also wasn't afraid of God's will. Both his experience and his faith was so deep that if it came to him, he knew it came to him from God. And if it came to him from God, if everything came to him from God, why would he ever be afraid? And of course, this is what the Bhagavad Gita says. The Bhagavad Gita, just verse after verse after verse, compares two things that everyone thinks of as opposite. You know, sorrow and happiness, gain and loss, praise and blame, life and death, sickness and health. And just continuously, that's what the Gita does over and over again, from every possible angle, tries to tell us that there are no opposites. There's only one reality. And even though we think we're experiencing opposites, we're only experiencing the one behind those opposites. But that doesn't mean, I mean, even in the life of great masters, Master himself was betrayed. He was sued in the courts. Money was taken from him. He was vilified. You know, many things happened and that were quite unpleasant. And Swami Kriyananda's life was filled with challenges. He himself never thought of it that way. When people would say, how many difficulties and obstacles you've had in your life, he would say, what obstacles? I mean, things had happened that required willpower to overcome. But the definition of bad, the definition of suffering, he transcended that. Because if it came from God, why would I not welcome it? And if it came from God, how could it not be good? And how could anything come to me that was not from God? So he had confidence. He was fearless in his belief that if it came to him, God would also give him the capacity to do the needful, whatever that needful might be. Whether it was sickness or health or failure or success or praise or blame, it would just be what was happening. And there was no need to clothe it in a thought. And so as a consequence, the heart is the place where, the tender place where all of our feelings rest. You know, heartbreak is what we say. And anyone who has experienced it knows that it's true. It just, the heart is what hurts. And those experience of heartbreak are not easy to overcome. And Swami had his share. So it wasn't that he didn't experience the fullness of life, but he wasn't afraid of it. Fear is everything. In the Christian Bible, as it turns out, I believe it's St. Paul. Perfect love casts out all fear. I first heard that from Vivekananda. I didn't know it was from St. Paul. But there it is. Great masters all say the same thing. And perfect love, the only perfect love there can be, has to be the perfect love of God, because all other love ultimately will disappoint. I mean, even the most noble among us, unless that soul, him or herself, has also transcended egoic limitations, there's a limit. But God's love will never disappoint. So that perfect love, both received and given, makes us completely fearless in the face of everything. And that's what I realized was the secret of Swami's brilliance, superconscious brilliance, human brilliance, intellectual brilliance, was simply that he wasn't afraid. He wasn't afraid to feel what he felt, but his feelings did not cause any anxiety in him, and therefore his mind was not clouded. And therefore his heart was open, and therefore his spine was straight. So you see how it all plays together? So we can work this not just from pulling our shoulders back, but isn't it so that when we wish to undertake a difficult task, isn't it how we get ourselves ready to do it? We just pull ourselves up and then we march in. you're going into a room and you're not afraid and you just march in. You know, I actually was hearing something about Princess Diana, of all people, who is, you know, seems to have, you know, had a tremendous positive impact on the world. And when the reality of her difficulties and her life and the dissolution of her marriage and all of those things was coming forth, and she was deeply embarrassed, you know, she felt humiliated by the revelation of what she'd been going through in her private life. And a friend of hers that she wanted, she was scheduled to go out and meet the public. She had something she had to do, and she didn't think she could do it. And a friend of hers, you know, picked out the dress for her to wear and the jewels that she should put on. And then they practiced together this strong forward walk and reaching out with a firm handshake. And then they showed a little film clip, you know. Everybody, you can learn from everybody. We can't be snobs. Anybody who faces life with courage, with an open heart, is a teacher. The bumblebee is a teacher. The honeybee, only finding the sweetness, is a teacher. Everything is a teacher. And there was this picture of Princess Diana in a beautiful dress with her beautiful jewels. Just, you know, as soon as the car door opened, she stepped out with everything she had and just walked right into it. Just straight up like that, you see. So realization, you have to also understand, that word realization, the fact that the spiritual path is described as an ever-increasing state of realization, it's not acquisition. I mean, that's an extreme difference. We don't acquire something that we don't already have. We merely realize what we already have. And that is something to meditate on, my friends. Because the consciousness of lack, the consciousness of insecurity, the sense of inadequacy, the regret over past stupidities, it haunts us. Those are the thoughts. My friends were telling me that they were just thoughts. And I listened thoughtfully to her telling me that they were just thoughts. But they are just thoughts. Because we are one with the Infinite Spirit. And this is how, at the end of this cosmic drama, every saint who's realized God never feels angry at God. Rather, it's like, oh my goodness, what a good show it was. Because it was never really there. In one of my books, Ask Asha, I was trying to talk to someone about, I got these questions off the internet, I mean not off the internet, off my website, people sent in questions. For a period of time I answered the questions until I had enough for a book. But it was a question about why does God make us suffer, which I felt a little presumptuous answering, because I experience suffering. But I was thinking, I wrote, and you know, it's writing is the same as speaking. I write to learn. I don't write to teach. I speak to learn. That's why I do it, because it's necessary for me to constantly re-examine these ideas on an ever deeper level, become clearer and stronger. In myself, so that I can realize too. But if we mistake a stick for a snake and live in fear of what that snake might do to us, and conduct our entire lives in order to avoid that stick which we think is a snake, and then discover it was only a stick, is that stick responsible for our suffering? If a friend, if you believe that a friend has betrayed you, and you become angry and you become hurt, and maybe you become estranged from that friend, and maybe a whole cascading series of events take place, all based around what you believe was the wrong action of your friend, and ultimately, whether it's in this incarnation next week or lifetimes from now, you realize that your friend never actually betrayed you, that it was a terrible misunderstanding from the beginning. Is your friend responsible for your suffering? Where did your suffering come from? Now, this is really, so all the masters tell us, what's happening on this planet, that we think we are being punished and tortured, and in fact, we are being graced, and we are being given the opportunity to realize who we really are. But sometimes we have to be pushed very, very hard before that realization comes. Ram Dass, Richard Alpert, who recently left the planet, he was a great teacher for many people. I found Swami Kriyananda immediately, so I'm not speaking for myself when I say that. But he had a very positive influence on many, many people and really helped break open a lot of people's thinking. And he had a stroke at maybe 10 years ago, as long ago as that. And it hit him right where he lived, which is that he developed a form of aphasia, which is an inability to form words or a difficulty forming words. I think he gradually recovered some, but he'd been a brilliant and extremely eloquent speaker, and all of a sudden words were became an agony rather than an effortless flow. And he described what happened to him as he had a stroke, but he described it as being stroked, that his guru had stroked him, because he knew that it was a gift from his guru. No matter what an obstacle it was to his life, he'd been stroked. And then later, there was a documentary, which is really quite moving, which was called Fierce Grace, which was his extremely clever, but divinely clever way of saying it. So that's our straight spine, friend. That's your open heart. That's your fearless heart, which pulls your spine up and then helps you to realize who we really are. Now, I had invited you at the beginning of this to offer us questions, and apparently we have one. So let's hear your questions. Normally, what used to be normal, when I would do this in front of an audience, before we were practicing social distancing, March 17th, 2020, there would be people in the room, and now there are none. So your question is?
Maybe you could repeat this for the camera, but the question is, if the pandemic is coming from God, does that mean that this is an opportunity for us to learn to transcend fear and bring a new vibration to the world?
The question is about the pandemic. If it's coming from God, is this an opportunity for us to transcend fear and perhaps bring in a new consciousness? Absolutely, there's not the slightest doubt. I mean, of course it's true. Now, it's not just true based on reverse engineering, which is it's coming and everything comes from God. But it's also true because Master has promised this from forever. And Swamiji has reiterated from forever. And common sense, looking at our world, the world is so out of balance. And people are so stressed and life has become so, like the word I want to use is unnatural, in so many ways that you can't keep mocking divine law. I was reading something about American Indian consciousness, the Native Americans, and they were talking about how Native Americans honor you for what you give away, not for what you accumulate. And I believe in the Northwest, and forgive me if I don't have this exactly accurate, but there would be a gathering every year, and everybody of the Native peoples, and everybody would bring what they had accumulated during that year and give it away. And, you know, you were honored by how little you walked away with. And give it to those who were in need of it. But nowadays, just think of the stunning accumulation and the stunning disparity that is set into our world and how we admire, what we admire, and so on and so on and so on and so on. I mean, it goes on and on and on. I don't have to say it. So we're out of balance, and it's not helping us spiritually. It's confusing us spiritually. And Master promised that God was going to correct things economically, socially, spiritually, in every respect. So for all the years that I've known Swami, he's just been waiting. We've all been waiting. Master's predictions were for war, for economic troubles, for depression, for shortages of basic commodities. Swamiji has spoken of enormous population reduction. He even referred once to people crowding into the planet specifically to go through cataclysmic changes that will end their incarnations in dramatic ways. All so that we can, as a planet, as a global society, come back into balance. But it's not going to be a quick change because we're in a cycle of yugas and the yuga is just beginning. However, soul destiny, the drama of each individual soul is the real drama. The planet is the material world and it's temporary. And as soon as the physical body is gone, the whole material world becomes entirely irrelevant. And simultaneously all over the cosmos, there are heavenly planets and there are dark planets and there are high yuga planets and there's low yuga planets. And the astral world where we go between our material incarnations, from there we can go to a dark planet, to an elevated planet. I mean, Jesus incarnated in Kali Yuga descending here. It was the darkest time of the planet because the individual soul drama chooses, the individual soul chooses the right material circumstances in order for it to learn its next lesson. Period. Whether that's Kali Yuga descending, Dwapara rising, the peak of Satya Yuga, the sinking of Atlantis, a pandemic in 2020, on planet Earth, in early Dwapara, our soul had the choice, guided by God and Guru and our guardian angels, before we took incarnation in this body, in whatever year you took it, you had a choice. And all the karmic forces, all karma being unlearned lessons, all the unresolved issues that are keeping us from realizing our true nature made a perfect pattern, which is reflected in our birth horoscope. And we entered into the sperm and ovum, came into a womb, so that we would be able to live through a material cycle that would exactly serve the soul's purpose, which is to realize God. So whenever one is faced with a difficulty, and the pandemic happens to be global, but whatever difficulty one's faced, I was having a conversation with a friend who'd had a severe crisis and nearly lost her liver function, almost disappeared. And as she expressed it to me, a liver function is on or off. You know, you have one, and if it's off, it's off. And you either have a transplant or you die. So it was really serious. And she was trying to figure out why it happened to her. And, you know, there's lots of books that'll say this means this and that means that. I'm not going to dispute any of it. This is how I work with it. If I have physical illness, if I have mental anguish, if I have obstacles in the material world, if I'm faced with the potential of a pandemic, if I'm now giving my class only to a camera because I can't be with more than 10 people in a room, whatever it might be, I ask myself, how does this unsettle me? What does it bring out of me? And the word is fear, because fear is usually the source of everything. Certainly for me, fear is the basic anxiety. What does this bring up in me? What am I afraid of? And that's what it means to me. It's just as simple as that. You know, what anxiety is awakened by this material experience, and what is the antidote to that anxiety? Now, I can say faith in God, sure, but how do I get to that faith? Because if I had sufficient faith, I would be like Swami. Pandemic. Wow. You know, and I haven't been like that. I've been struggling, as everyone else has, to escape from the global mindset, to adjust, to change circumstances, to look with equanimity on all kinds of possibilities, just all the things that everyone's facing. Huh, look what this is bringing out of me. And exactly as you say, what a glorious opportunity. Now, will there be global shift? Because it's a rising yuga, Master says there will be. But global shift, it is not something that happens from the outside. Global shift is the direct result of one by one by one by one, each of us opening the heart, straightening the spine, realizing God's present within us, and becoming an instrument for that light. You know, this is the times we live in. Swamiji said that most of the time, this is how he described it, most of the time in less tempestuous times than we find ourselves in, society is divided. There's a few very good people and there's a few very evil people. And most people kind of hang out in the middle. They just live their lives. They're neither particularly good nor particularly bad. So the curve of society is like a fat cigar. But in times like this, what's happening is the middle is shrinking. And there's great light coming into this world because it's an uplifting yuga. And Paramahansa Yogananda has incarnated, and many great souls have come to earth at this time. So there's a great deal of light, and also there's a lot of darkness. And these viruses are living beings. They're dark beings, and they've been attracted by dark energy. And so there's a real battle. You can't just kind of hang out in the middle. You know, you just can't hang out in the middle. It's not going to be business as usual for the foreseeable future. And as long as that challenge is there, we get to get bigger. So are we being cursed or are we being blessed? You see what an interesting and fascinating challenge it becomes? And that's our job. It's always been our job. But in times like this, it's more dynamically clear. And the opportunity, therefore, for growth is all that much greater. So, my friends, God bless you.